Investors are going for the gold.
And the silver, the platinum, the palladium.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, November 9th. Coming up, could a visit by the Dalai Lama be bad for business? Plus, we'll visit with one of New York's top chefs.
But first, gold hit an all-time high today, topping $1,412 an ounce. And the big question is, why? Why are investors putting their faith in gold? Marketplace's Elisa Roth joins us from New York. This is the highest prices have been, Elisa, since everybody worried that Greece could go bankrupt back in June. So what's happening now?
Well, it's really the same kind of flight to safety that we're seeing. Investors are nervous, and they want to put their money someplace that'll make them feel better. I talked to Justin Urquhart-Stewart this morning. He's an investment manager in London. He says it's about feeling secure.
I almost see gold as a bit like being a financial teddy bear. You can cuddle it, you can hold it, you can put it on your pillow next to you.
Now, people have clearly been anxious about the economy for a while, and that's reflected in the gold prices, which have gone up something like 1.5 times in the last 2 years. Right now, though, people are worried about the dire fiscal situation in places like Ireland and Greece again. They're concerned that the Fed's attempt to stimulate the economy could lead to inflation, which would be bad for the dollar. And then there's this G20 meeting this week where they're going to talk about currency.
I confess I'm not feeling so warm and cuddly right now. What's the connection to the weak dollar?
Usually the price of gold goes up when the dollar falls. So people who might otherwise put money into dollars turn to gold instead. The other thing is it's not just gold. People have been buying all kinds of precious metals. So platinum and palladium prices are both up. And silver is going for $28 an ounce, which is the highest it's gone for in something like 30 years.
Elisa Roth in New York. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For more on this story, we're going to turn now to Julie Neiman, an analyst at Smith, Moore & Company in St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So what's the deal? Why is everybody buying gold?
Well, there's no demand for gold. Industry isn't buying it because it's so expensive. Jewelry. Nobody's buying jewelry because it's so expensive. What gold is now, it's become an alternative money. Nations can't manipulate it like they can their currencies. And nations are trying to cheapen or devalue their own currencies so consumers can afford to buy more of what they make and export. That's great for the exporting countries, but it puts all of your trading partners at a huge disadvantage. They retaliate by cheapening their currencies, and you get into this global conga line going to the bottom here with trade retaliation, trade wars, potential inflation. Nobody wins.
So it's this global currency we've been talking about. And I assume that the Fed's action last week to buy an additional $600 billion worth of treasury bonds played some role here. Is this the effect that Ben Bernanke wanted when he did that to stimulate the economy?
Well, he's got a tough position because his first mission is to take care of the U.S. He wants to get our economy out of the swamp by floating it up on this big sea of dollars, you know, very low interest rates, easy money. And that basically is dumping all this money into the financial markets. That does make the value of the dollar go down, makes our exports more attractive and more attractive for our global trading partners. The problem is all the repercussions I just mentioned. You get into this tailspin, and now you've got a fistfight going on in the schoolyard because every country wants to have the cheap currency. So that's the consequence of Bernanke's mission last week. So he has two bad sides of this coin.
Okay. Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith, Moore & Company. Thanks.
You bet.
To Washington now, where House Republicans are taking aim at the financial reform law that was passed earlier this year by Congress. The law includes limits on banks using their customers' money to buy and sell risky investments. It's called proprietary trading, and some experts say it puts the whole economy at risk. But as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, Republicans don't see a problem with it.
Alabama Republican Spencer Baucus is a leading contender to take over the House Financial Services Committee, and he's already warning regulators who are writing the new rules not to be too tough on banks. James Barth, the banking expert at the Milken Institute, explains why.
The financial crisis that began in 2007 was not in any way due to proprietary trading.
Republicans say the real problem was falling home prices and poor lending standards, so limits on proprietary trading won't prevent a future crisis. But Temple University economics professor William Dunkelberg says big banks did rely too much on trading risky assets.
Rather than on traditional banking and paying attention to the quality of assets that they purchased, like mortgages.
It'll take a year to craft new bank rules, and Republicans are ready to grill regulators if they think those rules are counterproductive. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A report out today says while investors have shied away from many managed stock market funds since the financial meltdown, so-called socially responsible investing has grown. Eve Tro reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Socially responsible investing means looking at the overall impact a company has on the world, not just its profits. Matt Christensen is director of the European Sustainable Investment Forum. He says in tough times, investors think that's a trustworthy approach.
One of the reasons is because many say it's about how you look at the whole portfolio now and being open about the reasons, the rationale, the investment methodology, the process.
In other words, transparency. Sustainable funds often screen companies for everything from safety records to carbon emissions. That attracts investors who want to avoid financial risk. Doing good is a bonus, says Kerry Krasinski at Trucost.
Sustainable investing is about trying to find value, not investing to your values. And that's a very sharp distinction.
A distinction, he says, can give this type of investing a real edge, not just a halo. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 9th. I'm Bob Moon. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. BP's former boss has admitted his company was unprepared to deal with the scale of the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Tony Hayward has been speaking to the BBC about the events earlier this year. Just last night, the Obama administration's inquiry into the causes of April's environmental disaster found no evidence that BP or its partners cut corners to save money. From London, the BBC's Rebecca Singer has more.
Tony Hayward stepped down as chief executive of BP at the end of September, but he's given the BBC a frank account of events during the Gulf oil spill. He says BP were making it up day to day and argues what was going on was some extraordinary engineering. But when it was played out in the full glare of the media, it looked like fumbling and incompetence.
We tried to be open and transparent. We gave access to the operation. But the reality is we were completely overrun and just not prepared to deal with the intensity of the media scrutiny.
During the crisis, BP's shares fell by as much as 50%, and Hayward told the BBC that at one point it was unable to borrow money from the credit markets. BP lost more than $17 billion in the quarter coinciding with the Gulf spill, but last quarter the company announced it returned to making a profit. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Some of Europe's biggest airlines could be hit with fines today totaling more than $1 billion over price fixing for air cargo. The EU Competition Commissioner is expected to hand down his decision today. For more, let's bring in Marketplace's Stephen Beard from London. Stephen, if this is going to cost them more than $1 billion in fines, I suspect it cost us a lot more than that. What's alleged in this case?
Well, this is the European part of a global investigation. The central allegation is that more than 20 big airlines were colluding with each other to fix fuel surcharges on their cargo operations. They were, to put it bluntly, ripping off their customers. Now, the US is ahead of the game in dealing with this. In the US, total fines of more than $1.5 billion have already been levied against airlines that fessed up to it, and four executives have been sentenced to jail.
And what action are we expecting in Europe?
The European Commission is expected to fine 10 carriers, including British Airways and Air France. It could fine them 10% of their total revenues. Total revenues about $10 billion, so a total fine of about $1 billion is possible. But the airlines have been pleading poverty. Some have argued that given the really tough times they've been through, a hefty fine might put them out of business. So the Commission may go a bit easier on them. But the airlines still face a lot of pain over this. Hundreds of air freight customers are suing the airlines for damages for overcharging.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Bob.
Wherever he goes, the Dalai Lama has an impact. Many who attend his events say they feel enlightened by his presence. But Tibet's exiled spiritual leader leaves a profound economic impact, too, and not in a good way. Researchers looked into the economic consequences of a Dalai Lama visit in 159 countries, and wait till you hear what they found. Here's Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
It turns out the bald, red-robed Nobel Peace Prize recipient is an economic downer wherever he goes. That's thanks to China's leaders. They fume each time they see the face of Tibetan independence sitting down with one of their trading partners.
They usually say that in terms of economic retaliation, you're just going to have to look what happens. It usually implies that people should look out for some fallout in the future.
Economist Nils Hendrik Klan helped author the study. He found that countries hosting the Dalai Lama lose, on average, 8% of their trade with China in the 2 years following the visit. Klan says this Dalai Lama effect sends a clear message about doing business with China.
The way we usually interact among each other in terms of the trade and diplomacy might not be the way that countries will interact in the future with these new rising economies.
The results, by the way, didn't hold for every country. President Obama met with the Dalai Lama earlier this year, and it led to some good karma. U.S. exports to China are on track for a record-setting year. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 9th. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We continue our Future of Transportation series now. Houston, Texas is probably best known as a capital of big oil, but the nation's fourth largest city is also trying to position itself as a leader in electric cars. From KUHF, Wendy Siegel has our story.
Software developer Steve Cobb is showing me his 2002 Chevy pickup in his office garage.
Well, this is the bed of the truck, and there are 26 batteries in the truck.
2 years ago, this Texas native took out his gas engine and swapped it for a battery pack.
This is the sole energy source for the truck, and as you see on the side there, the cord goes in where the gas tank used to be.
Cobb doesn't worry about draining his batteries on his 16-mile commute between work and home, but others may be more anxious about running out of power with no plug-in sight. Mayor Anise Parker says Houston provides the perfect testing ground for the electric car.
We're a sprawling city that's built around the automobile. If we can convince Houstonians that electric vehicles are the way to go, then it can work anywhere.
Right now, Houston has just 10 public chargers, but there's federal grant money to build 25 more in the coming months. They'll be installed in places where people park for a while, think malls and city parking lots. And a big chunk of the charging network will be paid for by a power company called NRG. In Houston, NRG is planning to spend some $10 million on roughly 60 chargers by the end of the year. David Crane is the CEO of NRG.
They will never be more than 5 miles away.
NRG will install two types of chargers, including the rapid charger, which gives a half charge in just 15 minutes. Crane says there's still a debate over how many chargers need to be at each location because no one knows what the demand will look like.
It would be extremely frustrating for someone to limp into a charger station and see that there are five cars in front of them, each of which was going to spend 10 to 15 minutes.
Early adopters could also fork out $700 to $2,000 for a home charging unit and power up overnight. But even if you can keep your battery charged in Houston, it could be years before there's a network that allows electric vehicles to drive the 4 hours up to Dallas. In Houston, I'm Wendy Siegel for Marketplace.
Start spreading the news.
This is a Manhattan-bound
New York City has almost 19,000 restaurants, and right at the top of the lists that rank the best ones, you'll usually find a restaurant called Danielle. Well, today we welcome the chef and owner, Danielle Boulud, to Marketplace. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
I want to start by asking you, You've got five restaurants in New York. You've got a front row seat to the economy right now. How have you felt the recession and the recovery in your restaurants?
It's all about value and how people trust the people who give you value for your money. People care about indulging to themselves. There's a lot of luxury they can spare, but fine dining is not the one they should just get rid of.
What is a person to do to have an economical but delicious meal?
I would say, for example, there's one dish who is a pork shoulder. You buy a 7-pound pork shoulder. You put it in a pot with some sweet potatoes, and there's all kind of spice and fruit and wine, white wine, and root vegetable, and you braise that for 4 hours. You take it out, and you have this amazing meal for a real affordable cost, real affordable.
Okay, now I'm sure you're used to doing things very quickly. I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions and quick answers.
Yep.
Most stressful part of your day?
Getting up in the morning.
All right. When you go out to dinner in New York, do you tip 20% even if the service is bad?
Often 20 plus.
Even if it's bad service?
Yeah, because for me, everybody can have a bad day.
What's the best cheap eat in New York that is a restaurant that you don't own?
Daisy May Barbecue.
All right. And finally, assuming that New York is the number one food city in the country, what is the second best food city in the country?
That I'm going to get really hurt if I say that. But I would say then certainly Chicago, it's the most amazing city behind with New York.
Well, Daniel Boulud, it has been an honor to have you on the show in our first week in New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and I look forward to speak to you soon again.
One more thing. Say goodbye to a name that's become something of a cultural icon since we were first introduced 36 years ago. Mr. Goodwrench is about to be buried along with Pontiac, Oldsmobile, Saturn, and Hummer in the General Motors brand graveyard. The carmaker reportedly plans a nationwide conference call with dealers today to outline its plan to, shall we say, retool its car servicing shops. The aim is to give each of its remaining product lines their own clear identity, so they've come up with these clever names instead: Chevrolet Certified Service, or Buick Certified Service, or Cadillac Certified Service. Gotta say, Jeremy, it kind of made me think about something one of those Goodwrench mechanics actually told me: if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
That's a line that will last for a long time, I think. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.